Sri Lanka remains under a state of emergency as authorities warn the terror threat may not be over. This is following Easter Sunday's wave of deadly bombing attacks. Teams from the FBI and the London Metropolitan Police have now arrived in Colombo to help local security officials with their investigation. This comes as new details have emerged about the 9 suicide bombers, with reports that one of them studied in the UK before doing a postgraduate course here in Australia. Meanwhile, a video has emerged of the suspected ringleader of the attack, Zaharan Hashim, pledging allegiance to the leader of the Islamic State group, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Well, the death toll from the bombings has now climbed to 359. That makes it the deadliest attack linked to ISIS. Lydia Khalil is a former intelligence advisor to the Boston Police Department and a former counterterrorism analyst with the New York Police Department. She's currently a research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. Lydia Khalil, welcome back to RN Breakfast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Lydia, the Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, and the US envoy to Sri Lanka are warning that the terror threat may not be over. They say there are still people on the run with explosives. Does this indicate the government is aware of, knows of active threats?
Well, this is certainly a very live situation. We've been hearing reports coming in that there's still explosives that are being found, additional arrests that are being made. And so certainly the terror threat to Sri Lanka has not completely been controlled.
And the Australian Federal Police are helping out. We know that. The London Metropolitan Police and the FBI now have all sent teams to Colombo to help the local security officials with the investigation. From your experience, Leah, what kind of work would they be doing? Why are they there in these numbers?
Well, in a terrorist incident of this size and magnitude, particularly with a connection to an international terrorist organization like the Islamic State, it's going to garner the interest and attention of international and regional security agencies. Because Islamist terrorism is such a global problem and has a global impact, all of these countries have a stake in what's happening in Sri Lanka. It's not just confined there. So you're going to have these international liaisons from around the world and other organizations like Interpol going in, assisting the Sri Lankan authorities to gather additional intelligence, share whatever intelligence they have that might be relevant to individuals or trends or targets in Sry Lanka and the region, and try to help the Sri Lankans not only to piece together what's happening in their own country, but also make connections to what other networks and potential plots may be going on around the world.
And in terms of that, it's been revealed that one of the bombers, the suicide bombers, had, for instance, studied at some period in Australia, at an Australian university. Is that the kind of link that will be followed through to see if there are other links to see where the radicalization happened?
Well, it seems pretty clear, at least from the information that we know right now, that this individual was radicalized in Sri Lanka and that their time in Australia was only just very tangential and had nothing to do with what they did in Sri Lanka. So there doesn't seem to be any major linkages to their time here in Sri Lanka in terms of their radicalization or the terror threat.
And in terms of their radicalization, investigators have now identified 8 of the 9 suicide bombers. The government says almost all of the attackers come from well-respected, educated, upper or middle-class families. Does that surprise you? Is this akin to the bombers who carried out the 9/11 attack, that same kind of background? Why is this group, why are educated, relatively wealthy young men and women getting involved and radicalized like this?
It doesn't surprise me at all. I really would love to see that perception that the individuals involved in terrorism are poor, uneducated, really put to bed, and I hope that this attack does that.
And can I just interrupt you there, because it comes from the notion that there's a group of disenfranchised young people and they get preyed upon in a sense, doesn't it?
Exactly right. And also there was a trend of individuals, particularly going into Islamic State in Syria, who were disaffected, who did come from low-educated and lower-income backgrounds, who went to Syria. But that has been not necessarily on trend with what we've seen in terrorism more broadly, and particularly in jihadist terrorism. Most of the ranks do come from middle-class, well-educated individuals. And frankly, if you are poor and uneducated, you have other concerns to deal with rather than spending your time reading texts and engaging in an ideology.
But can we talk more about that? Why? Why would they come from respected, educated, middle-class kids? I mean, these kids have travelled the world. They've seen other ways of living. Why? Why would they be ripe for radicalisation?
Well, radicalization is a highly idiosyncratic process. Everyone kind of has their own individual trajectory to go from engaging with an ideology to actually committing violence. So it's hard to pinpoint particular factors exactly. But that being said, though, you have to have some certain level of education and free time in order to engage with these things. You have to have some sort of understanding of the politics, the political grievances behind this, the religious ideology behind it. And so you do have to have some sort of level of education and spare time to do this. And you have to have resources in order to follow through in your actions.
You're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 6:15. Our guest is Lily Khalil, former intelligence advisor to the Boston Police Department, former counterterrorism analyst with the New York Police Department, and currently research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. Lydia, the Sri Lankan government has admitted it failed to act on warnings before the attacks and that some of those warnings came from foreign intelligence services. We're now reading this morning in The Guardian that Sri Lankan authorities were told informally by Indian authorities for security agencies 4 months before of a network of violent Islamic extremists active in the country, and nothing was done. What does that say about the capacity, I suppose, of the Sri Lankan intelligence agencies?
Well, this was an intelligence failure of massive proportions. There were many, many warning signs. Their information from their own investigation and arrests that the security services carried out in Sri Lanka, and regional trends that were ignored. So this was a big failing on the part of the Sri Lankan security authorities. Much of that stems, I think, from the legacy of the 2018 constitutional crisis that pitted the president and the prime minister against each other.
And yet in this case, both those men say they weren't told of these intelligence warnings either. Both of them are saying it.
That's true. There was a clear breakdown along many lines. There were compounding failures regarding the intelligence that was or was not shared and what actions were taken and were not taken, mostly were not taken based on the intelligence that they had. So there were breakdowns all along the intelligence and policy spectrum here in Sri Lanka. And it was the legacy of this 2018 constitutional crisis. And perhaps there was a bit of the idea that they were still fighting the last conflict. There's a sense of complacency that set in Sri Lanka after they defeated the Tamil insurgency, and it was very hard to shift to taking a look at emerging threats around the corner, which were coming from jihadist actors who did not have a history of action in Sri Lanka. But that being said, there was intelligence that was shared and that was given. And so at the very least, the fact that warnings were not given to the public around an Easter holiday, mm-hmm. or that there were not security protocols that weren't stepped up is very difficult to understand.
So Sri Lanka's president has moved now to sack the defense secretary and the inspector general of police. So there'll be a shake-up at the top levels to try and, I suppose, ensure that something like this doesn't happen again, maybe get rid of that complacency or that mindset, as you say, fighting the last war. Would there be pressure on Sri Lanka from, you know, the FBI is there, the UK Metropolitan Police are there, the AFP are there, from countries like America, Britain and Australia for Sri Lanka to tighten up, smarten up, I suppose?
Well, Sri Lankan political leaders are facing an intense amount of pressure over this and the need for accountability from those international partners, like you said, but most of all from the Sri Lankan people who are most affected by this. There's a lot of anger toward the political leaders over the failures, and the fallout from this is going to be pretty severe.
And Lydia, just before I let you go, we now have this news out of Turkey that the Turkish authorities have arrested someone with links to ISIS, when the theory that they were perhaps planning an attack on the Anzac commemorations at Gallipoli. I mean, does this activity signal, you know, ISIS is on the march since it's been defeated in its what once was known as its caliphate, that it's moving externally?
Well, what it does signal is that the defeat of Islamic State's territorial caliphate did not diminish it as a threat. From at least 2 to 3 years ago, the Islamic State was preparing for the loss of its caliphate and had started to transition to more international terrorist type of attacks, transition to a more global terrorist
network. As we saw in Paris, for instance.
Yes, that's correct. So they're going to be relying more on their international affiliates, regional networks and regional affiliates to carry out international attacks in order to maintain its relevancy as an organization and to use those as kind of vectors for the ideology that it's trying to promote. So the Islamic State has been preparing for the loss of its caliphate for many years now. This is a trend that counterterrorism analysts have been warning for many years, and now we're starting to see not just now, but for the past couple of years, we're starting to see that come to fruition.
All right, Lydia Khalil, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lydia Khalil, former intelligence advisor to the Boston Police and former counterterrorism analyst with the New York Police and currently research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney.